Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me as usual is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up on past episodes. We most recently talked about The Five Bloods. Before that was Modern Times, Copland, Bo Burnham's Make Happy, and The Long Goodbye. I also wrote a book. It's available on Amazon. It's called Content About Content. It's a series of essays about various pop culture topics, Shia LaBeouf, Hilary Duff, Run-DMC, Eminem, The Social Network, Pulp Fiction, yada, yada, yada. And if you don't enjoy supporting Amazon, just get at me on Twitter and I will send it to you. No questions asked. We're at the MacGuffin Man. But yeah, let's get to the theme song. James.
Yes, Alex.
We're here today with a classic twofer. We haven't done a classic twofer in a while.
That's true, actually. Yeah. I didn't think about this. Yeah, but we're a 2-4 and a feature filmography for
it. Yeah, exactly. per MacGuffin Men tradition, we will be fully ignoring the shorts.
Yeah, that's great. Right. Mm-hmm. But we'll be talking about the two feature-length films of Ari Aster, mm-hmm. which would be 2018's Hereditary.
Correct.
And Midsommar 2019.
Correct. The numbers check out.
That's right. And I want to do both of these just because I found in watching Midsommar, thinking about Hereditary a lot, and because they were made so close together, and because this is a relatively young director with a lot of promise, and they're not redundant films by any means, but they're not so wildly different that it's impossible to talk about the both of them. So I thought it'd be fun to look at both of them together and kind of to see what he's been doing and where he might be going, and kind of what you liked and didn't like about these first two films that he's made.
Yeah, and I mean, he talks about it as, like, I think this is a bit of an oversimplification on his part, but he talks about it like he made both films back to back. Like, when Hereditary was in theaters, he was on set making Midsommar. So, like, he talks about, like, the success of Hereditary just totally passing him by because he was on set making another movie, because when you get the money to make a movie, you have to make that movie as soon as you can, because the money might disappear at any moment. So there are certainly overlaps in the between the two movies, but also I do see them as pretty distinct movies, for sure. You know, he's got too much talent to make the same movie twice.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And
even accidentally.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you said, these were done so close together that, you know, I've heard people ask him about being a bit more ambitious with the second film, with Midsommar compared to Hereditary. And, you know, he kind of disregards that. He kind of, because as you said, he made them so quickly, he gives off the impression that he didn't feel successful and that he had bought himself the liberty to do something a bit more experimental. I guess we can start with Hereditary. It does seem more like someone's first film. You know, it's fewer sets, it's not as kind of spacious in the way that its story is told in the editing. But I guess we can talk about, let's talk about Hereditary first, and then we can get in a bit more about what separates them and why they are similar as well.
Yeah, for sure. Just while we're on our way to Hereditary, just a quick mention of something about Midsommar. Like, I think they're kind of similar scaled films. They have basically the same number of sets. It's just one of those movies takes place mostly in an open field, and one takes place mostly in tight and closed spaces. So it's just by the nature of where they are in Midsommar, it just looks grander. That I think that is a big part, you know. And there are slightly more main characters in Midsommar, you know, but like I think they're basically the equal size scale, more or less. One just happens to be outside in a field and one is inside in a house.
Mm. Right. Mm. Yeah. And I've heard it sort of described as domestic horror or psychological horror, and people do want to, they're pretty quick to talk about these horror films as different than, you know, a slasher film. And I think that's something that I think it's said about every horror movie people actually like.
Yeah, every horror movie that movie critics like. That's what it is.
Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't just rely on the jump scares. But I think the domestic horror is a good sort of name for this one, just because he's been pretty open that both films, and again, we'll stick to Hereditary for now, are very concerned with more of our natural world than the supernatural. And even though there's definitely those elements in both of these movies, definitely in Hereditary, he seems to be very conscious about saying this is a family drama that's a bit of a nightmare, or, you know, it's this domestic film, or it's a breakup movie, or it's a family drama with some horror elements to it. And do you find that true with Hereditary? Does it feel that much different than another horror movie, or does it feel like a family drama?
Yes. Yeah. And so I think the main thing that we're talking about is that, like, the difference between, you know, to put it in, like, we've seen more action movies collectively than we have horror movies, right? But the action movies that we talk about on this podcast are ones that have interesting action sequences, but also give us something to talk about outside of the action sequences, right? And with a horror movie, the action sequences are just the things that freak you out, you know? And there's not most of that, most of the things that are frightening about Hereditary are more tension building things. They're more that sort of prolonged Colin Stetson score that's just constantly going just underneath these very tense scenes. And, you know, like, one of the most horrifying scenes is somebody who can't breathe at a party just being driven away, and you don't know what the end point of that scene is going to be, but you're still very, like, you know, locked up in this sort of, because everybody knows what it feels like to not breathe, you know, like, that's something that, in fairness, will always get me in a movie. It's like, really loud heartbeats freak me out, and when a character can't breathe, it freaks me out. And so, like, you just get caught up in that, and it's not really the looking around the corner for somebody with a large knife, you know, because those are movies that are more more reliant on genre conventions, I guess, which I think this movie is a genre movie, but I don't think it plays by all the conventions, you know? And I think the horror is put on top of the drama elements, as opposed to the drama being, like, fit in between horror elements. I think that's the short way of describing that thing. I just took very long to say, a long time to say.
Yeah. I mean, this is a movie that, you know, it starts off with a death that we don't see. So, I mean,
The first shot is an obituary, you know?
Like, yeah. Mm. And so, I mean, that's just, you know, that seems so counterintuitive to what a horror movie is to kind of put us in this spot instead of, you know, maximizing every, you know, every death to, you know, to put that crudely, but, you know, in a product like this, that is what's being done. And so we get, you know, we spend so much time with grief in this film, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, the terror of somebody dying. It's so much of the aftermath and what that does to a family. And, you know, the grief is awful enough of having someone in your family die, someone that everyone was close to and seems to play a big role in this family. Mm-hmm. But, and so that grief is palpable, but then there's also all the things that come up, and this mother and son relationship is kind of fraught, and you just get the sense that so much is unsaid. And, you know, they talk about the grandmother having been very private, and we get the sense that there are a lot of things in this family that aren't being said. And you do sort of get the feeling that, you know, they're healthy. It doesn't seem like an abusive household or anything. People have, you know, their own personal issues, but it doesn't seem like you're meant to just see this as an awful domestic situation. But that grief and that death works at bringing so much of that stuff to the surface, and that's so much of the emotionally engaging content of this film is not the emotions of fear or, you know, disgust or horror as much as there is of that. So much of the what I find, at least the really, and seemingly critics, is that interpersonal family drama and that stuff kind of brought up as a result of a death.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's basically the idea is that it's sort of a family that's ill-equipped to deal with the tragedy that happens when Charlie dies, you know, like because they're the type of people who don't talk about things with each other by the sounds of things or by the impression that we're given. They just kind of handle things on their own way. Like after Peter's grandma dies, his dad Steve is checking on him. He's just like, how you feeling? Feeling a little sad. Peter's reaction is just like, and Steve's reaction is, I get it. You know, like it's the perfect, that would be my exact reaction in that situation. Yeah. And so it just sort of, I think that paints a picture of a family that's like not super open with each other and maybe just doesn't have the capacity to be, like, because some people just aren't great at being open with other people. And then when something like Charlie's death happens, they're just wholly unprepared for what that does to them and how to react to what that does to them, because the first time they start talking about it, they start blaming each other, you know, and it's like, yeah. It immediately becomes these things that sort of fester. And I'm talking about the dinner table sequence, the things that would fester when you don't talk about something that is bothering you. And then when they burst out, it's just the things that you have built up in your own head angrily about the other person, you know. And something that I think should be mentioned about this movie is that it was marketed as sort of like a demon child movie, you know. It was like something like The Omen. Like if you watch the trailer for this movie, it's really terrifying. Like it's a great trailer, but the idea was that Charlie was going to be around for a lot longer in the movie than she was, at least physically. And that makes Charlie's death much more shocking, you know. And and I think that's an important aspect of this movie being as successful as it was, is that people were sold a different movie than what they got. And that's why sometimes when the person gets a different movie than what they're sold, they're unhappy about it. But the person like us who gets a different movie than they're sold, and it ends up being something that they're very interested in, it ends up paying off even better, you know.
Yeah, and that death is so shocking. It I do see the comparisons to, I mean, people say Rosemary's Baby or The Exorcist, you know, some of those 60s, 70s films of kind of that demon child thing you were mentioning, and even a lot of parallels to The Witch more recently. Do you see those films in here too?
Oh, 100%. Just like Rosemary's Baby, just in the amount of time you were confined to one location. This is a bit bigger than the apartment in Rosemary's Baby, but I think that's... I know he has said it was an influence, but like if he said it wasn't, it would be an obvious lie. You know, like it's just... but yeah, and I think that one's pretty obvious. But you can also see... I forget some of the family dramas that he did actually vocally cite as inspirations, but it's just anytime there's an argument around a dinner table, it's like, that's not a horror movie trope, you know. That's an Oscar drama trope more than anything, you know.
So, yeah. Yeah. And the that idea of so much of it coming from that family aspect and not necessarily the horror elements, there's so many things in this movie that are tough to watch, and you know, some awful things and a different variety of the definition of that word. But in rewatching it and thinking about it, just the fact that she goes to grief counseling and isn't open about that fact, like she's not open about the fact that she's being open with other people, you know what I mean? And that her family would probably love to hear that, but that's not the way she functions, or the family functions as a whole. I find that so heartbreaking. It's someone who really needs people, doesn't feel like she can do that with the people closest to her, and, you know, is doing it elsewhere, which is fine, but to not be able to even tell the people closest to you that you're looking for that kind of help or open to it. I don't know, just on the kind of the on the family drama level, I find that so devastating.
Yeah, well, and I think something that I found interesting about that is when she's at a support group, she talks about, she mentions to her husband that she's going to the movies, or she was at the movies, and he doesn't ask, what did you see, ever, like either yeah. time that this happens. And so I wonder if that's either way, it doesn't reflect on them well as like being open and sharing people, but like you know, if there's one follow-up question built into what did you see, you know, to that answer, you know, it's like, what movie did you see? So either yeah. he knows where she actually is and knows that she won't talk to him about it, which sad, or he actively doesn't care what she did once she left the house, you know, which is also sad. And I think the truth probably lies closer to the former than the latter. But one thing that I found interesting about the support group scene that I didn't really have an answer to when I was watching it is she says that, like, she, you know, that first support group scene where there's that long take of the camera pushing in on her while she's going on a monologue. She mentions how she was forced to go to a support group a few years ago, but she doesn't really clarify why. Did you catch anything like that?
I didn't catch an explanation, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. And so that was something that was interesting to me. It's like, there's so much sadness and trauma in this movie that they're referencing things, events that we don't get explained to us, you know, that are also traumatic enough to drive you to a support group.
Yeah,
presumably with her husband. Like, that sounds like that's who would have forced her, right?
Right. Yeah, because she talks about her brother's suicide and just that side of the family, especially the males, have a pretty long tragic history. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it would have been her brother's suicide, right? I forget the timeline of that, but...
Yeah, and I don't know that it's spelled out too clearly there. You talked about the moving camera. What do you think of a almost constantly roving camera and the visual style of this whole thing?
It's great. like, I think yeah. the main thing I would say is patience is the key for how the camera moves. And, you know, there's a lot of... I don't want to call them, like, I would call them like long-ish takes, but not the type of showy long-ish takes where you're like, here's a YouTube compilation of the 10 hottest oneers, you know, like where it's the opening of Boogie Nights and all these things,
yeah.
Where it's like really drawing attention to the fact that it's a long take. Ari Aster doesn't shoot coverage, which means that he does detailed shot lists for how the scene is going to play out. So that means he can see how it's going to cut together for the most part in editing. And Hereditary, it's pretty obvious, but it's even more obvious in Midsommar. But the shot is the shot, and we're not going to shoot something to save our ass in editing. So you get something like when there are a couple examples of surprisingly long takes in this movie that just don't feel like long takes. So when, Annie is coming out of the craft shop and she sees Joan in the parking lot. And then Joan walks up to her, and then they go to Joan's car and they're talking about, I think this is eventually what gets Annie invited over for the seance. But all of that plays out the whole scene. It plays out in 1 3-minute take, but you wouldn't think about it as a long take because it just doesn't draw attention to the fact that there are no edits. And another great example of that happens a little bit later when, after Peter has sort of bashed his head against the desk at school, school calls Steve calls Annie, and their conversation on the phone happens. She hangs up the phone, she goes back to work, she gets a call from the art gallery, which is the Ari Aster vocal cameo, and then that scene just continues with her just working on her miniatures until she breaks the chair and we get a cut to her close up. And that's another 2.5, almost 3-minute shot. But again, like, you don't notice that these are long takes. And I think that's something that is, it's something that we hit a lot on this, but like the fewer times you have on this podcast, I mean, the fewer times you have to edit, chances are like it gives you fewer opportunities for a viewer to be pulled out of a movie, you know? And, a perfect example of a scene where there would be more editing traditionally is when she's doing the seance with her family, with Peter and Steve. And the camera, instead of like shooting independent close-ups of all three characters, we get the shot on Toni Collette, on Annie, and then we're sort of like drifting over to Steve and drifting over to Peter for their lines, and it's just, you just don't have the cut, you know. You just don't need it, and so the viewer is less and less being given repeat shots, you know. You're not seeing the same close-up mixed with the same close-up back to back to back for 3 minutes, where you're just re-registering the same old image. This is, like you said, a constantly roving camera. It's just constantly giving you something new, but it's not giving you something new in a way that's like, look at me, I'm new. You know, it's just sort of like, it's drawing you in. It's not pushing you away.
Yeah. And
that's so important in a movie that tries to build tension, which Hereditary absolutely does.
Yeah. And, you know, tension in a couple ways, you know, tension, you know, when we have these demons or possessed people on screen, but even, you know, the uncomfortableness of a little cutting remark just kind of said, instead of, you know, and instead of having an edit there, you just kind of sit in that room with those people. And we've all been in that room where, you know, you or somebody else says something and other people hear it and you know that. And, you know, you kind of just dwell in that moment for a second. So for that, for those shots to hold a little bit longer and have, you know, that kind of tension and that kind of discomfort, as you said, it's perfect for, the themes and the characters of this film, to have that reflected in the language of the filmmaking is so perfect.
Absolutely. And the other thing you need to make that work is great actors, and like everybody in this movie is fantastic. And so like, you can come up with the most wonderful shot in the world, but if Toni Collette isn't holding your attention the whole time, then that's when you're going to have to find a way to cut away, just keep the viewer engaging. But Toni Collette doesn't make mistakes, apparently. So, you don't have to worry about that. And even, you know, I think Gabriel Byrne and Alex Wolff both have to do quite a bit in shots like that. And Anne Dowd, of course, I think she's great in everything. But these are, for the shot to work, you need to kind of nail every aspect of production. Like the shot design needs to be cool. You need to do a lot in post with the sound to sort of continue like grabbing somebody through another sense, but then also just the main thing that you're focusing on, the thing that you're pointing the camera at, or the human that you're pointing the camera at, has to be compelling, you know. And I think that's something that a lot of times can get lost in talking, when we start talking about like filmmaking construction. It would all be boring if the person you're looking at isn't worth looking at, you know, worth paying attention to.
Yeah, I the first time I watched this, I totally just, sometimes a really good performance just passes me by because I don't even think about it as a performance. It's just being done so well. And yeah, Toni Collette and the range on this one of stuff she's done, it's so fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Like we talked about the Five Bloods last time with Delroy Lindo, where it's like, you get to do everything in the Five Bloods as Paul with Delroy Lindo, and Toni Collette gets a different version of the same thing in this movie. Like she gets to push all the buttons, and nobody dislikes Toni Collette as an actor, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And the other kind of one of the big visual elements of this is that the miniatures, the dioramas, the sort of dollhouse effects, and you know, we're introduced to that really early on when we're looking at one of these miniatures, and then we zoom in on it and it's become one of our, you know, full size sets that you know, it's Peter's bedroom, and that's very cool, and it, you know, it looks great, it's impressive. And then as we get deeper into this film, we get a bit more of this idea of you know, we're kind of, there is a bit of an exhibitionist element to this. You know, we're watching this family, even by film standards, it does seem like, because you said, as you said, there's not that many sets here. We spend so much time in this house, and just, we kind of have a seat at their dinner table for these extremely, these extremely intense conversations. And just that idea of, you know, looking at this as kind of, you know, an exhibit of people in a zoo or something. It's, they built this house on a soundstage because they wanted to have those walls just not there, so they could shoot this like you're looking in on something, or it's you know, it's one of these models that she would make with the fourth wall removed, and you can just look in on this. And that's, you know, it's kind of what we get. We get this little box with three people in it, and then an event or a topic or some long simmering feeling that's never been vocalized between these people, and you kind of just have them in this box and you shake them around, and then you watch the result, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it does really, like you said, show the constructs of the set. It's like Tim Burton does a lot of that, and so does David Cronenberg over the years. And I've never really liked it, with the exception of a couple Tim Burton movies. But I love it in this. And also, I mean, it just sort of ties into a lot in the storytelling of the film, like the what you're saying about the push in on the miniatures in the opening. I think it's the first shot, because we get the shot out the window looking at out the treehouse, right? Which is where the movie will end. Camera tracks back a little bit. It's panning over. We're seeing Annie's work. And then we're pushing into the house. And we get to Peter's bedroom, which is where the first scene comes in. Like, as you said, Gabriel Byrne walks in, and we just watch a bit of this domestic drama. It's like, hey, kid, put on your suit. It's funeral time. And something that I also liked about that is that, you know, we're already in their house, and we're looking at pushing into a smaller version of their house. And I mean, the movie's called Hereditary. It's about passing down things from generation to generation. Literally in the end credits, like a letter from a person's name moves down into the next person's name. You know, if you're watching through the end credits in the beginning, like an R in Ari Aster moves into the cinematographer's name. And the whole thing is about, you know, the certain things that haven't been fixed by previous generations then affecting current generations and future generations. And so this house that we're spending our time with is just a smaller piece of a bigger story that we're just not seeing, right? Like, we're not seeing the whole family history. We're seeing three generations of this family history. But there's more to come, you know? And I thought that was a really, really cool thing that those miniatures do. And not in a very showy, I mean, by nature, the shots are quite showy, but the way that it works in the miniatures as something that works with the sort of generational feel of this movie, I thought was really cool.
Yeah, no doubt. And I've seen that sort of take on it. And then I've also seen the idea, because by the end, you, in no uncertain terms, get the understanding that the cult has been kind of guiding the actions in their lives, and mm-hmm. you know, that they had something to do with Charlie's death somehow, and that there's you know, that their thumb was on the scale kind of guiding this family towards the end. And because that part of the movie is not the part that I'm interested in nearly mm-hmm. as much, you know, you know, it's just, that's not the part of this movie that is so interesting to me. Mm-hmm. You know, that idea of them being played with, like, you know, at like dolls in a little dollhouse really goes out the window for me. But just that idea of your genetics and your family history and what you've been taught by your parents and by their grandparents and how all that goes through. And, you know, the very sort of biological fact of mental illness and some of these traits being hereditary and being passed on through your genes, but then some of the more you know, behavioral, a bit more abstract idea of you learning how to be a person by watching your parents be people and watching your grandparents, and so much of that is out of your control, and that's, to me, the more interesting reading of these people sort of being dolls, that there are these things that they feel they can control, but then there's so much that either happens to them by luck or happens to them by, you know, the genetic lottery and what's already inside them on a DNA level, and how those things that it feels like you have control of it, because it feels like the most self-based thing about you is how you act. But so much of that is predetermined by, you know, genetics and things that are outside of your control, and the nature and nurture that you don't have much say over. And that seeing that played out is the much more interesting version of that same sort of visual metaphor.
Yeah, no, I agree. And something that I like about the miniatures is they don't hit this too hard, but the idea of Annie as an artist being able to retreat to her work that nobody else really understands, you know, like when she's having that conversation with, it's very brief, when she has that conversation with Steve, when she's doing a representation of the scene of her daughter's death, like, and his response is, I would argue, quite justified. Like, what are you doing? Yeah. This is wild. Don't let Peter see that. And she's like, her response is, why? It's a neutral representation of it. And it's like, okay, some people can't have neutral representations of these situations, you know, like, and
I'm straightforward retelling of something that traumatic is the worst version of that, right?
Exactly. And just the idea that when anything like is bothering her with, you know, or any relationship with her kids or her husband, she has somewhere she can retreat and work on something that is not vocalizing her issues. She can work through her art. And I thought that was an interesting way to, I don't know, just to work some commentary on art and the artist into the movie as well.
Yeah. And she's, you know, on a downward trajectory for all of this movie, I suppose. But when she destroys her art, when she no longer has that refuge and in fact, you know, stops it from existing, that really seems to be a turning point that there's no coming back from, and things get, even by this film standards, you know, pretty dark and violent and heavy from that point forward.
Yeah, for sure. Something that I think we've kind of ties into what we've been talking about already is the portrayal of sleep in the movie, and where characters sleep. Like Charlie has trouble sleeping or doesn't like sleeping in the house. She sleeps in the treehouse before she dies. And once Charlie dies, Annie has trouble sleeping in the house. Like we see her sleeping in the treehouse multiple times. We see her one of those times literally get out of her bed with her husband, grab the blanket and go to the treehouse. And then in between those two instances, we see her asleep in her car when Peter's coming home. And she eventually goes off to a support group, I think. But still, she is sleeping outside of the home. Whereas Steve sleeps just fine in the house. Even when he's sleeping on the couch and his wife is lighting, like her arm is on fire in front of him, he's so deeply asleep on this couch that that even something like that can't wake him up. And I thought the way that the movie, maybe that's why she's uncomfortable in the house. Like she doesn't feel like anybody's sort of watching over her anywhere. So what's the point of the safe confines of the house, you know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So, I think Steve might take one more sleeping pill than he usually does in that scene. That could be why he stays asleep. But also the fact that Annie never thinks to make a noise to wake up the person on the couch. But, I don't love the ending of this movie. I will say that. I think all the satanic stuff, I'm just like, I don't know. Maybe this just isn't for me, this part. But I think everything that gets you to the last 5 minutes, I love. And I think the way that it's executed is great. But it feels like it's a more interesting movie that then cops out at the end, at the very, very end, you know?
Yeah, and I kind of go back and forth with sort of both of these films too, that there is it seems to tie into the plot of Midsommar more at the end of it, for all the kind of spaciness that movie has that we'll get into, but I do kind of agree with that one where I just don't know how you end a horror movie without really having sort of the most horror elements right near the end. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just kind of one of the difficulties of these movies, that we want kind of that more cerebral drama stuff, and because that has more interesting ideas. But it's hard for those metaphors to be in their most interesting form when we're getting them distilled down to the things that we find least interesting about this stuff.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, maybe it might just be satanic cult in general. Like even, I don't know if I said it on the Rosemary's Baby podcast, but my least favorite part of Rosemary's Baby is the last 5 minutes, you know, like it's just I don't know, maybe it's just something I don't like in movies. Maybe I'm too afraid of Satan to embrace these things.
Yeah. That's probably it.
Yeah. My lifelong fear of Satan strikes again. One thing that I do want to talk about, and I think this will kind of tie us into Midsommar, if you're cool to move on.
Yeah.
The way teenagers are represented in this movie is at times wonderful and at times incredibly corny. But I think there's something that... Ari Aster is just young. I think he's 32, 33 right now. So he's closer to, you know, let's say he's filming this in 2017, you know, in late 20s. So he's just closer to being a teenager. And I think there are certain things in this movie that really represent being a teenager very well. There was like when Alex Wolff is the actor and Peter's the character, is talking about how he wants to have the car for the school barbecue, and then she says, okay, sure, so you won't be eating with us. And then he's immediately caught in a lie, but not really caught in a lie, and he's like, well, no, I still need food, so I will eat at home, but then we're just going to hang out at the barbecue. And I just thought that was a really, really interesting, like, or really funny note of a teenager not fully thinking through their lie. And I really enjoyed that, and like just a text message, come to this party, bring your dick, like, and especially that conversation when he's already at the party and asking the girl on the couch if he should come to the party, and it ends with them leaving to smoke weed. I thought those moments were really good.
Yeah, I really like that exchange a lot between those two.
Yeah, it's funny. But then also, like, the counterpoint to that is that in your entire high school career of going to a party, did you ever witness people making a cake, you know, like at the party?
I don't think so.
Yeah. And also kids talking about their Facebook, talking about Facebook statuses in 2018, as we covered on Bo Burnham's eighth grade. It just doesn't scan, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're making that cake, but then also a different dish that has all the nuts in it.
Yeah. It's just and none of those things seem to have drugs in them, you know, like I could understand maybe baking if there's drugs in it, but it's just, I don't know, nothing about that made sense to me.
Yeah, that checks out.
The most predictable transition to Midsommar, I really like the way the Midsommar shows college kids, you know, the group of friends, the way that they're portrayed, and I think certain elements in the language and how they talk to each other are really interesting and funny, and in a way that I don't always see represented. Like, we've talked on, I can't remember the specific movies, but like sometimes in college or as a teenager, you're friends with people who it doesn't make sense for you to be friends with, but you are just because you're physically present with each other all the time. And yeah, these people together don't necessarily feel like they would be friends 5 years after this movie takes place, even if none of the horrifying things happened. I guess they all die, so they don't still exist 5 years later. But they're just around each other all the time, and the way that they're talking, and when Danny comes in and after Christian has sprung the whole "I invited her to Sweden" thing on them, that whole sequence, the way that plays out, him waiting for till the last possible second to tell them that he has invited her, but she's probably not going to come, which means she's definitely going to come, and yeah, they don't want her to come. And then he says, "This was your idea, just so you know." And then he immediately opens the door, and Danny is there. And all of this has to be done through glances, or all this communication between those three guys has to be done through glances. Florence Pugh, Danny walks in. She says, "Oh, hey, Mark, what's up?" And he's just like, "Chilling." And she's like, "Yeah, that's cool." Like, and it's just the most, I don't know, everything about that is just screams like perfect encapsulation of college. And then Mark really puts a button on it by asking Christian to come take a look at this paragraph real quick.
In another room.
Exactly. But doesn't remember the laptop initially. And we don't get to see that conversation, but we've experienced a version of that conversation, you know, so we don't need to see it. And then a cherry on top of a cherry, when Josh gets up and like microwaves his beverage to make it slightly warmer than it was, that's just an excuse to get him to allow him to leave the room without making a thing out of it, so he could go read in peace as these people talked around him. And all of those things happened in probably a span of a minute, and I just thought, like, I don't think I've ever seen like a a college living room portrayed that well on film, you know, like, and so I thought that was, and things like that run all throughout the movie, but I think that really sets up where this group is, and it's so early in the movie that it sets the tone for a lot of what's to come, at least in their interpersonal relationships.
Yeah, and just similarly, like we said with Hereditary, without the good performances, it's not nearly as effective. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And shout out to Will Poulter and Florence Pugh and William Jackson Harper. Like, I think they're all wonderful in this.
Absolutely. I think Jack Rayner is really good too.
Yeah, he kind of has a it's a bit of a weirder role because it's pretty quiet. Mm-hmm.
Well, his character, I have the most questions about, like, his reactions to things don't always make sense to me. So, like, he's the character I understand the least. I think that might be partially by design. But I certainly think that he gives a very good performance in this movie. But I couldn't really explain why. Whereas with, like, William Jackson Harper and Florence Pugh and Will Poulter, that's Mark's name, right?
Yeah.
All great.
You know? I think he's fantastic.
Yeah. And I'm a card-carrying member of the Florence Pugh fan club, as I think I made very clear on our Little Women podcast. But
right. Yeah. And so you said that you're sort of unsure or ambivalent about Christian. Mm-hmm. Are we meant to like him? And I think it's really central to your understanding of this, I think, because this one, I mean, I guess Hereditary is sort of, you know, a horror movie, but it's truly sort of a family grief sort of movie. Mm-hmm. That fun subgenre. Mm-hmm. But no, that seems to be the sort of emotional element that we're supposed to be caring about a lot. It's sort of grief and what that does to a family and what a tragedy can do to families that are kind of just getting by, and then this thing comes and sort of animates a lot of these unspoken strong feelings. And this one, Astor always talks about, this is a breakup movie. This is, you know, the way that was a sort of a family drama. This is about a relationship that's coming apart or is already apart. And the horror kind of walks us through a lot of these ideas and, you know, what's it like when a couple isn't on the same page and all of these things come up, you know, and obviously in our lives, things rarely get this extreme, but that seems like one of the main ideas is two different people dealing with sort of a different circumstance that they're not used to. Mm-hmm. And as you grow up and face different things, you know, in your life and mature and have other challenges and opportunities, that's something that is very important about the partner that you choose to be with, is how you're going to react to things that you've never come up to before. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that's a big part of all this. But I've also heard him talk about this being something, Astor, I mean, this being something sort of therapeutic for him, that this was, you know, he'd been through some serious breakups, and I think he kind of sees himself as the Danny in this, and that the people around him, you know, I've heard him use the phrase wish fulfillment, that he is Danny, sort of gets what they want in a perverse way, that bad things happen to the people around you, and that you know, the person that you were in a relationship with, to put it lightly, things don't go well for them after the relationship, and that Mark, who we see is, you know, if you're a card-carrying Florence Pugh member, he's a card-carrying Danny not appreciated.
and
is working to not only just to end their relationship, but even when Danny's around and when she's not, he's sort of the most crude person and is talking about women in a very disrespectful way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just the rudest one, and bad things happen to people like that in horror films. And so this is a long way of asking, but are we supposed to like Christian? Are we supposed to see Danny as sort of the victim of a bad relationship, and we want bad things to happen to him and his friends as a result, or what? Where do you see that?
That is not entirely my read. I don't think, okay. I'm not rooting for bad things to happen to Christian because he's wrong, Danny, or vice versa. I've heard Ari Aster say something to this extent, but he sees parts of himself in both Danny and Christian because his argument is we've both been on either side of the breakup. Or sorry, we've all been on either side of the breakup. You know, we've all had our hearts broken and we've all broken hearts. And so I think there are I can see both sides, I guess is what I'm saying. And as far as it being, well, okay. And so the other thing that I think is so crucial to this situation that they're navigating together, or sorry, their relationship that they're navigating together, is that this totally impossible situation happens to them right as it seems like they're about to break up, right? And
the death of her family?
Yes, exactly. Her whole family dying. And like, nobody knows how they would react in that situation because, like, it's, like I said, it's an impossible situation. And by the way that the movie presents it to us, Christian and Danny might have just sort of run their course, you know, and it seems like, well, his friends are definitely trying to talk him into breaking up with her, and she is trying to avoid calling him at the beginning of the movie before she finds out that her family's died, and you can see her sort of struggling with the idea of calling Christian, you know, like her thumb is hovering over his name on the phone, and that first conversation that they have is like just kind of awkward, and you know she was trying to not be to feel entirely dependent on him, which is also vocalized in her conversation with her friend on the phone right before she calls him. So it kind of just feels like they were at a natural end, and then something so horrible happens that Danny needs somebody. And like, how would you possibly break up with somebody in that time of their life? You know, like, yeah. It's just, I think they're just both in a totally impossible situation. And I think that, I think something that's really telling in the movie is later on when, they're asked by Connie and Simon, I think are their names. Is that right? The other couple.
London. Yeah.
Yeah. And, they're asked how long you've been together. Danny says 4 years, 2 weeks, and Christian says 3.5 years. You know, so like, just do the math. Her family dies in the winter. They're now in the middle of summer. There's 6 months that one of them accounts for that the other one doesn't, because I think Christian had fully planned on the ending of their relationship, you know?
I never thought of it that way. That's a good point, though.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty telling. I think it's just this trauma that nobody knows the right way to navigate, because there's no way to navigate it. It's just, you just have to figure it out, and there's no right answer because there's only wrong answers, you know, like you're dealing with a situation that's only bad, you know? So,
yeah.
So I don't think we're supposed to see Christian exclusively as a villain. I don't think we're supposed to see Danny exclusively as a hero. And, he gives us more reasons to dislike him than she does, to dislike her, but yeah, I just think that impossible situation.
Yeah, no, I think that's true, because I think that even if this movie is giving us reasons to dislike Christian, he's not a monster. You know, he wouldn't end that relationship then. You know, yeah. He's not that big of a villain. I don't know that he's a villain at all.
Well, and just to, as we were, sorry to cut you off, but like when we were talking about Jack Rayner and trying to figure out how to describe why we think he's good in this movie, I think the shot of him walking to Danny's house in the snow, as he knows what's happened and he knows he's about to walk in, and then we cut it and he's holding her on the couch and we push into that window and we get the opening credits. The shot of him looking at her apartment from the outside, like how what's going to happen? Like, how does this situation get resolved? I think that one shot, he's so good. Because I do think you see the internal conversation of, I wanted to break up with this person. Now what do I do? And then also seeing her side of things. It's not totally self-interested, because in that situation, how could anybody be self-interested? You know, like, So I, yeah. And I think you see, I can see all of that on his face in a 10 second shot, you know, and I think that's a really powerful testament to his performance.
Yeah. And no, I think that's a good point. And I think that so much of this movie to me is about empathy. And you brought that up of him trying to imagine it from her perspective. And, you know, if I imagine some of that thought process is, you wouldn't want to lead somebody on if you know that it's over, but you also can't end things right then. You know, that's not the right thing to do either. You know, if you care about this person at all, but you think it's just not a good match, you don't, you wouldn't end it then. But I think empathy is something that it's in Hereditary too. And I think it just, he kind of takes that idea that you see sort of seeds of in Hereditary and absolutely runs with it here. Mm-hmm. And yeah, to me, it's kind of the most interesting theme in this. And I think that Midsommar is more interesting than Hereditary. I liked it more than Hereditary. I think it's gotten more complex ideas and a lot of things to just sort of bounce around in your head mm-hmm. after the fact. Mm-hmm. But I think that this sort of this broad notion of empathy is the idea that I think is the most interesting and kind of they get the most mileage out of.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you sort of, because I agree with everything you said. I haven't thought too much about, I guess, empathy from the perspective of Midsommar outside of everything that I've already said, you know, like I've used all of my empathy points for this stuff, you know, like I'm curious to know like what else you see as being about empathy in the movie.
Well, it's this idea that you want someone who's like you, you want someone who is happy when you're happy and, you know, not, and just is so genuinely, similar to you. And that sounds sort of, you know, self-obsessed and self-serving, but someone who, you know, your values line up so much that you can, go through the same things and know what to expect. You know, as I was saying, as these characters grow older, they're going to be facing things that they hadn't faced before. So you want to know that the person who's on your team is going to see things the same way. And so, for example, when Christian is told by Danny that Simon left without Connie, you know, he says, "Huh, that's weird." And then kind of quickly gets back to what he was doing.
Yeah. And he's asking questions about the, for the people.
From the commune. And that's a moment we kind of just get the slow pan in on Danny as she processes what that means to him and how they saw that news. I mean, she rushed over to him to explain it to him and he kind of couldn't have been bothered with it, right? And it's something very important to her. And he may find himself in that situation. But that is, I guess, especially when we see members, or not even members of that family, but when the commune sees people express emotion or feelings, you know, for example, when the man mm-hmm. jumps off the cliff and, you know, his legs break and he's sort of wailing out in pain and they all empathize with him and they all make the same sounds. And we see it during that sex ritual. We see it with, you know, many times. That seems to be this common action of theirs is when these extreme showings of emotion happen in front of them. What they do is, you know, just mimic it and not, you know, it doesn't seem like it's insulting in any way. It's just, this is the way that they show that they're all one family when someone experiences such extreme emotions that they're all going to experience it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Together.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And that's super meaningful as a family. And it seems like that's one thing that really draws Danny in. She feels, it seems like she feels so separate, you know, it's from all the other characters we've met, especially all the guys at college, that, you know, they're all male. They don't have the experiences that she has. And we just get so many times where someone will say something and we see her reacting differently than other people. We just know that her feelings are not being represented by the conversations other people are having in front of her. And I think that when it's important to keep in mind that, you know, she must feel so alone. Literally her family has died. You know, her sister, who she seemed very close with, her parents, who, you know, they seem to be in constant communication, seemingly have a loving family life, that when all of that goes away, you search for family. And I think that I'm still sort of on the fence about this movie having her looking for a family and her looking for a partner, you know, the dissolution of her family and her relationship, sort of doubling down on this idea. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think it kind of muddies the theme, but then sometimes I think it works so perfectly. But the idea that she finds a group that is going to truly empathize with her, and, you know, Pelly sits her down and says, do you really feel like you're at home with Christian? Mm-hmm. And there's this idea that you guys both get along and you can seem happy and you look like a good couple and all these things, but you don't get that sense of community and that sense of empathy that these people share as their, you know, their big extended family in Sweden. And I think that that's part of this whole film, is that idea that how far are you willing to go for that empathy, and when it comes with all of these other things, is it worth it?
Okay. Yeah, no, I can see all of that with what you're explaining. And I think we have like similar but sort of different takes on the broad strokes of, I guess this will be a discussion for the ending for the most part, but yeah, I can see everything that you're saying. I think the end point for me is just slightly different, you know? But yeah, she's certainly looking for some sort of, or the idea of the movie is that she is looking for some sort of replacement family for sure. Something that I would love to have answers to about this movie is, what is her relationship with her friend Amy, who is the person who I assume is the person she's talking to on the phone at the beginning. And then she gets the text message when they first land in Sweden, when they're in the car, she gets the happy birthday a day early text from a friend named Amy. And so just naturally, I would assume that that is the friend she was talking to at the beginning. Like, I just would like to know something about their relationship, because that would be a friend that she has outside of the group that we are seeing throughout this movie. And I wish we had more information about her relationship with Amy, and just that surely by design, or maybe in the 4.5 hour full cut that Ari Aster likes to talk about. There's another scene where Amy is actually on screen and they hang out and or something, but I would be very interested to know that, because the way that she's shown in this movie, it's she has Christian and nobody else, but we see one other, or we get information about one other person, you know, and that other person at least seems like a better friend than her boyfriend. So like, just by nature of remembering not even remembering her birthday before like the calendar notification hits her, it's like getting there a day early, you know? So
yeah, you know what, I thought she was on the phone with her therapist.
They make a joke that she should be talking to her therapist, but I think it just seems like, I don't know, that felt like more of a friendship call to me, I think.
Yeah, and I don't know what therapist is taking calls at 10:30 p.m.
That was the other thing I was gonna say, but
I'm sure some do. But
oh, I'm certain some do. But like, I think the conversation just sounds like a friend conversation, not a therapist conversation. Okay, where to now? The plainest birthday cake of all time, the apology birthday gift that, that Christian gives Danny.
Yeah, and him not being able to light the candle is so perfect too.
Yeah, I do wonder if that was unintentional. It seems like that totally reads as something that could have possibly been unintentional and just works so perfectly, you know. And there's a couple moments in Hereditary where in the middle of a long take, like I remember Gabrielle Byrne at one point says, "What language is even that?" in the middle of a like 2-minute take. And it's like, that can't be the line, but it totally works in the situation where he says it. It's at the seance. But I do like that idea that, you know, sometimes when you're playing out these movies in these long takes, you have to get so much just right. Sometimes the one thing that's off feels even more perfect than the way you'd planned it, you know? I wonder if the failure to light the candle is a perfect example of that, because they both react to it perfectly, like Florence Pugh and Jack Rayner. And I don't know, there's just something about it that feels unfaked, you know, like it feels real, and then they react to it perfectly. Yeah. That's already way longer than I expected to talk about that sequence for, but I think something that that we missed talking about with Danny and Christian, and I think this will tie into something else I want to talk about with this movie, is that what you were saying when Danny says to him about Connie and Simon, how Simon left Connie, and he just immediately goes back to his questioning. And there's another portion. Oh, it's right after the head smushing ceremony. And Danny comes up to him and says, "That was really gross, right?" And Christian's response is, "Yeah, that was really disturbing, but it's cultural," you know, like, and it's just, it's the weirdest. There's something about him from like that portion of, or from that ceremony to through the rest of the movie, where he's just so weirdly calm all the time. And I think the thing that's odd about it is, or the thing that I think carries through, is that I think in both of those situations, he shows an academic interest in the people around him. And I think it's once he sort of settles on the idea of writing his thesis, something that Josh has been into, like, from as soon as we were introduced to him in this movie, writing a thesis on these people, this commune, it sort of just becomes an academic interest, and he sort of loses touch with any sort of humanity, including exploded skulls, you know, like, and I wonder how you feel this movie portrays academia as a pursuit, you know, and it's mostly through, I mean, it's almost exclusively through Josh and Christian.
Yeah, it's... That's an interesting question, because it does feel like this idea of cultural relativism is sort of central, and I was wondering, I mean, even to zoom out from that, about how it views or how it displays American culture, and you know, that's what we have to compare it to, right? We have these people going from a world that looks a lot like our own to this much different world, and not even just different that it's European, but even within, you know, that continent, the way that these people live is obviously different, you know.
Yeah,
this, the suicides and the how they just shape their families and how they have children is out of sync with what we kind of normally think of in Western culture. And especially right off the intro, there's sort of these beautiful shots of outdoors, and it's there's this very kind of beautiful melodic singing, and then it's interrupted with this really loud and really harsh phone ringing.
Yeah, and that's right as we cut to houses. Like, we cut to an image of the neighborhood that Danny's family lives in.
Exactly. I thought this movie would just be doing so much to posit sort of technology as bad, and that the way that these people, the other way to live is this much more natural, more beautiful way to live. And I mean, we definitely see it get played with, but it's not showing this community as the perfect place to live. And you know, we see these people, like as you were talking about, even people trying to look at it anthropologically with a bit of distance, still being very disturbed by it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's watching Danny deal with some of these really, really things that she sees as awful, and you know, these people dying right in front of her, but then the sort of peaceful way that they accept their death, and some of the other things that just seem so calm and beautiful when compared to her very recent experience with death. I think just the way that these students break the rules of the community and sneak into these temples and take pictures, to answer your question, I don't think it shows that world in a very positive light, to take everything that they've been given, and the way that they were let into this pretty small private community, and to overstep these very clearly delineated boundaries. You know, that certainly doesn't make a good case for academia.
Yeah, exactly. And I think going to your point about empathy, it's like the situation or the moments where we're talking about Christian, like how his reactions are very odd, and then he immediately goes back to his more academic pursuits. That's totally in line with what you're saying about empathy. Like at that point, he's not focused on how they feel. He's just focused on how they operate, right? And that's the difference between caring about a person and being interested in a person, you know, and or a community in this case. And so I think those things go hand in hand. We often see, or at least a few times, we see Josh taking photos or videos on his phone, or at least attempting to, and just by the nature of doing that action, he's removing himself one step from other people just by, it's, you know, it's like shooting a concert or like taking pictures all through the concert instead of watching the concert, you know. It's just a different version of the same thing. And I think something that what you're saying about the not idealizing the either American culture or the Swedish culture that we see here is the way that Danny's family dies is in a very industrialized sort of way. They're killed by cars, you know? And, but what makes cars go? It's just combustion that is controlled. And what kills everybody else at the end of the movie is combustion. It's just like to make the smoke that kills your family, you need fire in a controlled sort of industrialized way. But still plenty of people are killed in Sweden by a different version of the same thing at the end of the movie, you know, in the big triangle house. But,
yeah. So yeah. What do you think of this reading then? Because you said that it looks like we have slightly different takes. So I'll try to encapsulate this a bit more succinctly so I can get any contrast that you have. Is that, and I don't know that this is, I'm not saying this is the one proper reading of this film.
Oh, I think, I don't think there is a proper reading of this movie.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I think something that we talked about when we did Mulholland Drive is that to get through a movie like this or to find something interesting in it, you just naturally, somebody like us will gravitate to something pretty early on. And then we're either proven wrong by the end of the movie or we just keep giving reasons to sort of like lean into it, and the movie never gives you hard answers that you're wrong, so you're able to continue following your own path, you know, which is something I really enjoy, you know, like I feel like that's been made pretty clear over the years. But the it's also something that can be very frustrating if not done by somebody as skilled as Ari Aster. But,
right. Yeah, for sure. So we'll say that Danny sees the, you know, she experiences this horribly traumatic loss of the three members of her family dying. Less importantly, but still importantly, she finds herself in a relationship that the person is not the right fit for her. Mm-hmm. This is not her soulmate that she's found, and he probably isn't a horrible guy, but this is not the person that would, you know, they could have the best life together. Mm-hmm. And so by not having any family and not having someone who can truly empathize with her, and she's brought to this new spot. So she's in this commune in Sweden, and she sees a group of people that really empathize with each other. And they seem to be not only have a very harmonious relationship with each other, but a very harmonious relationship with the natural world. And that's something we haven't really talked about either. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned that I thought they might do a bit more of demonizing technology, but this Swedish community seems to be in a very harmonious relationship with the planet. And, you know, that's shown by them being outside in beautiful sun all the time, whereas everything in America is dark and dingy at nighttime.
Yeah, yeah. Winter versus summer as well.
Yeah, exactly. They, you know, they seem to eat very naturally and live in a very, you know, not industrial looking place. There's trees and there's water and plants and grass. And so not only are they harmonious with each other, but also with the planet. And they have a very close relationship. They're all brothers and sisters. And they even have this level of harmony with the life cycle that when you're 72, mm-hmm. you're kind of happy and like and proud to die and feel like you're part of this cycle. And even in death, you're still contributing to this community by being part of this grand life cycle that you've been enjoying the whole time when you're alive. And then, you know, you kind of feel like you made the ultimate sacrifice to keep the society together. And so Dani, who is feels so alone and feels like her feelings are never understood and aren't properly empathized with, that she finds some community that does that so much, that makes her feel at home and even elevates her to May Queen. And, you know, it makes her feel like you really do fit in here. You fit in here so well. You're the exemplar of someone who understands how we all live with each other. Mm-hmm. And that no matter how maybe atrocious or maybe out of sync with the morality she's built up to that time, that she goes for it. That not only does she sort of accept it by the end and smile and, you know, one of the last frames of this film, but we see it in the visual language that first her feet have a little bit of grass on them when she's tripping out on mushrooms, and then you know, that just gets expanded, and then eventually she's covered in flowers from head to toe, yeah. sitting on a chair made of flowers, and is very much co-opted into this natural world that we've been led to associate with the Harga and in this whole commune. So what do you think of that, of the idea that she takes empathy just to fully feel part of something, to not be alone and to feel understood, and that her morality makes sense to these people in a way that it never did to the people in her world?
Yeah, I see that. I see that for sure. And I have a couple things that I would push back on that with. One thing, I think one of my favorite, it's a weird thing to call one of my favorite things in this movie, but when right at the end, when the people are sitting in the burning building, and we have the two volunteers, one of them's named Ingemar and I forget what the other one was named, but as they've been given a sedative or something, but they're still conscious, as they realize like they're being burned alive, they start like, they look at each other, and they're just this visual conversation that they're having with their eyes, and then eventually their horrified screams, really gives me the idea of, in the last moments of being a cult member, when you're as you said, giving the ultimate sacrifice for this group, you realize how fucking stupid you were the whole time, and that this isn't worth it, and that's your last thought. And I think that's what we're supposed to get from Ingemar's death. And the other thing that I will say about the idea of this society sort of just being, the Harga being viewed as sort of like something kind of natural and pure and giving her what she needs or whatever, to quote Ari Aster, like he's constantly like in interviews, he's saying things like their bloodline has been carefully protected, you know, like all of these things that are just sort of give you icky ideas of what this society really is. And, you know, we see Josh reading a book in the car called The Nazis of the, I forget what the blank is, the other word in the title. And I just sort of think that this movie is saying, yes, that's what she thinks she's getting from these people, that's what she wants to get from these people, but it's not based in something that they're actually giving you, or it's something much darker than that, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I think that, it's definitely not this idea that these are, even for all those things I said about them kind of having this harmonious relationship with each other and with the earth, you don't get the idea that this is just American culture bad, this culture
no,
good.
No, not at all. No.
Right? You definitely aren't left with that idea.
Yeah.
And in this, you know, we kind of get ideas like this in Hereditary too, but especially in this, as you said, like, protecting the bloodline and all these, you know, eugenics adjacent ideas. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we need to explain why that's not a good idea.
I don't even think we need to say adjacent, you know, like,
right. Yeah. Yeah. But we know why that's not, biologically a good idea. And yeah. Why, you know, and then morally is, again, I don't think we need to explain it too much, but, just this idea of it's their family. But, and so that notion of having these values that you really appreciate and not allowing the outside world to affect them. And it's one of those things that sounds good to a certain point, and then you do it to the nth degree and you see this really isolationist this policy, what it can do, and just having no input from the outside world, and the inbreeding and the things that they have to do to keep the bloodline from, you know, being a full circle, just shows some of the dangers of living that way, and of being so so self-assured with your ideas being the only acceptable right ones, and then the other, everything else is deceit and murder in order to keep your society together, right? And
yeah,
it's similar, even just the title of Hereditary. You think of something hereditary and you think of family as these really great things and things that mean so much to you. You know, as I said, it's your genetics. It seems and it is so important and so fundamental to who you are, but just like hereditary things pass down the things that you like and value about your family, it's also where the bad things can come from, bad physical and mental traits. And then we see this idea again in Midsommar, that there is that point where having very good ideas and valuing your family, and then you run that down to the conclusion and you see that it's burning strangers and you know, having a gene pool like they would run into.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that I see in this movie, to tie it back to the idea of like the thing that Ari Aster has sold it as, the breakup movie, but I will read a quote from him that I found very interesting, because I think it sort of it talks to a lot of what we've been saying about how you can find a lot more in this movie, or you can find basically whatever you want to find in this movie, you know, to an extent. But he says something like, it's very hard for me to see exactly what I did. Doing these interviews is interesting because you have to find your talking points. You have to find how you're going to talk about it. Really, I just want to avoid saying anything, because he doesn't want to tell people how to feel, but he understands that he needs to tell them something. And calling Midsommar a breakup movie is it's an easy interesting way to describe what is a horror movie, you know. And I think I view this movie as sort of Dani's journey to or failed journey towards figuring out who she is as an individual, right? So we see her at the beginning, like her family is taken away from her. So like her birth family is taken away from her. And the rest of the movie is her realizing that Christian isn't the family that she should latch on to. And so she's latching on to the Harga, which is another family. But I think the end of this movie, I think, is not supposed to be positive in where Dani is currently, or that she still has more steps to go, you know? And I think that something that I found really interesting was that, so I forget which order these things happen in, but Dani walks into the barn as Christian is having sex with somebody. I forget her name. It's the whatever yeah. we're calling that scene. And she walks in and sees him, and then she runs back to the place where they've been sleeping. And it's the only handheld sequence in the movie. There's no real handheld sequence in Hereditary either. And this is like a Fincher classic, where you do one sequence in the movie where you shoot it handheld and everything else is extremely controlled. And it's where she's crying alone. And to tie back to what you were saying about the everybody being empathetic towards people's emotions, she's surrounded by other people who are also crying with her. And it's just this very shaky scene. And it's like, that's something where if you're in a relationship and you walk in that moment, it's something that would, for lack of a better phrase, shake you to your core, right? Like it would just sort of, it would throw everything off kilter for you. And that's what happens with the camera. And then from the end of the movie, or through to the end of the movie, we find her like latching on more and more to the Harga. She's May Queen. As soon as she's awarded May Queen, she kisses another man who's Pele. And it's just like jumping from one man to another man, you know, as opposed to being yourself in the middle of those two moments of your life. And I think I think the thing we are supposed to get out of the end of this movie is that Danny is watching part of her old life burn. But there's still more to go for her to become who she is. And I think something that's really telling that it was just an offhanded remark in an interview I was reading, but Ari Aster's like, the movie doesn't take place over 9 days. It's a 9 day festival. There's more to come, you know? And it's just sort of like, there are more steps to her figuring out who she is in this situation, but it is important that she stop jumping from family to family, admittedly because she is forced in the beginning to try and find something else, somebody else to latch onto. But the idea that she has to figure out what her own value system is, as opposed to jumping from person to person or person to cult. And it's also worth noting that I don't know exactly what age Danny is supposed to be in this movie, but it's certainly in her 20s. It's either early 20s to mid 20s to late 20s, you know, like, but that is a time where you're still very much in flux, and you can, it's really an opportunity to figure out who you are as an individual. And you can be an individual who latches on, or who is a part of a collective, I guess, in the instance of the Harga, or somebody who gets really into having a boyfriend like Christian or something. But that is the time where you figure out where you are or who you are. And I think what Ari Aster wants us to think is that the options presented to her thus far have not been positive, and she should keep searching, you know? And I think the something that, like, this is such a colorful movie, but in that finale, like, the colors are desaturated in the last scene of the movie. Like, they're slightly desaturated. And I just sort of think it's like, this also ties into what we've been talking about with the Harga earlier, like this sort of beautiful idyllic thing, even though, even when it's going up in flames, like it's just, it's losing color already. Like as she's getting closer and closer, I mean, I guess she's at the top of the metaphorical food chain right now. She's the queen, but the beauty of it is already starting to drain, you know? And that's why in that final close-up of the movie, which pairs not perfectly, but quite nicely with a close-up of her on the phone very early on in the movie, before she finds out her family has died. She is alone, and she is it's just her and the camera. And no matter what, at some point in your life, you're going to be by yourself, and you kind of need to figure out how you can react in those situations, what your decisions are going to be, you know, moving forward in your own life. You know, you have to be able to not necessarily look yourself in the mirror, but you have to be able to be alone in a room and know how you would act in certain situations, you know? And I think that's the last shot of the movie, is her kind of realizing she is still searching and she doesn't know who that is yet, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I think the fact that the colors are desaturating absolutely enforces that reading. And then it's, I think that's really good. It's the tragedy is, I mean, it's all the deaths are also tragedies, but
there's more tragedy in the first 10 minutes of this movie than there are in like most movies of a year combined, you know?
That's true. But the sort of the downbeat right at the end is, you know, all these awful things have happened to these other people, and yeah, she has been co-opted and elevated by this, but as you said, with the colors desaturating and fading like that, the kind of personal tragedy for her there is that she's moved on, but not to a better place. Like, she hasn't, as you said, sort of established herself as an individual. She's still sort of just jumped onto the next thing.
Yeah, and that next thing just happens to be a weird midsummer hangout in Sweden.
Yeah.
So,
I think that's a great reading of the ending.
Yeah, and I think it does work with your empathy idea as well. Like, it's just, we were on the same path, and we took a little bit of a divergence in the middle, basically.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. So, thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men, and check back next time, see what we're talking about.